Call this meeting of the Senate Resources Committee to order. Let the record reflect that it is 3:30 p.m. on Monday, March 11, 2019. Present are Vice Chair Coghill, Senator Giesel, Senator Bishop, Senator Reinbold, Senator Keel, Senator Kawasaki, who was here just a minute ago, and myself, Chairman Birch. See, I don't see any legislators in the audience. Please silence your cell phones. And I would just say we have one item on today's agenda. It's a review of current federal litigation issues by the Department of Law. The federal government owns more than 60% of all land in Alaska and about 224 million acres. This fact, combined with the problem of federal overreach on state, local, tribal, and private lands, sets the stage for disagreement between the state and federal government on a range of issues relating to land access, fish and game management, and the development of our mineral and oil and gas resources. Thankfully, we have the Attorney General and the Department of Law, whose duty it is to assert and defend the state's interest in these issues. Issues that matter deeply to Alaskans and that affect our ability to manage the destiny of our state. Committee members should all have a copy of the current Alaska Department of Law list of federal issues and conflicts dated January 21, 2019. Here to brief the committee and answer questions on the 25 or so cases on that list are, we have Seth Boisang, Chief Assistant Attorney General, Tom Lenhart, Assistant Attorney General, and Emma Pocan, Assistant Attorney General. I'd like to welcome you to the meeting here this afternoon, and thank you for the good work you do, and please come forward. You can put your name in the record. I guess we have room for three if you want to come forward. And we've been joined by Senator Kawasaki. And I think, as a matter of the doing the record, I think it's with obviously with two male voices. If you restate your name, if we break it up, but just your name and identification, and then we'll go from there. Please proceed.
Great. Well, good afternoon, Chairman Birch and members of the committee. My name is Seth Boisang. I'm the Chief Assistant Attorney General for the Natural Resources Section of the Department of Law, and. Let's say that I'm very honored to be before your committee. I'm very excited to be here. Thank you for having us. We're excited to tell you a little bit about the federal litigation matters that we're handling in the Department of Law. With me today is two senior assistant attorney generals. Tom Lenhart is to my left, and Emma Pocan is to my right. You do have, I believe, the list of federal issues that we are planning on talking to you about today. Some of the ones I understand that you guys have heard from other of our colleagues previously this session, so we're going to probably skip those, and they do deal with a lot of the navigability issues that we're handling. One of those is the Sturgeon case, which we're all eagerly awaiting the Supreme Court's opinion. But if it's okay, I will we'll skip ahead to the first matter that we're going to talk about today. And Tom, why don't you take it away?
Sure. I think we're all operating off this 8-page spreadsheet.
That's correct.
Okay, great. Thank you.
Good afternoon, Chairman Burke, members of the committee. I'm Tom Lenhart, Assistant Attorney General. And for the last 12 years, I've been counsel for the state on the roadless rule and most things Tongass. So if you're, you all have your lineup card, I'm going to cover four items on pages 2 and 3 under access of land, the roadless rule, the Shelter Cove Road, the King Cove Road, and the 26th Amendment to the Tongass Land Management Plan. Actually, I want to start out by combining the roadless rule and the Tongass Land Management Plan, because it's impossible to talk about roadless litigation without also talking about the Land Management Plan and, in addition to that, the current USDA rulemaking that's underway. Because of time constraints on these four topics, you're obviously going to get a very superficial overview. And I would encourage you to stop me at any time and ask questions about what you really want to know about, because I'd rather talk to you about what you need and want to know than what I wrote down here. So please don't hesitate to stop me.
Thank you.
Starting with the roadless rule, just really brief background. You're probably all familiar with it. But in 2001, in the last week of the Clinton administration, USDA promulgated the roadless rule. It effectively withdrew from future development 60 million acres of national forest nationwide. To put that in context, that's more than 2% of all land in the United States. not more than 2% of the national forest, not more than 2% of federally owned land. It's 2% of the United States. In Alaska, in addition to the Chugach, just on the Tongass, that's 9 million acres where virtually all road construction and timber harvest is now prohibited. And obviously that had a dramatic effect on the Alaska timber industry and some other activities as well. To jump to in the 18 years since its promulgation, the state has remained very busy in seeking relief from the roadless rule. It's been a three-pronged effort in all branches of the federal government. We've been in federal court almost nonstop. We've worked closely with USDA in rulemakings to try to obtain some relief. And our delegation in Washington has also been active, and on numerous occasions they've introduced federal legislation to exempt the Tongass, which hasn't been successful to date. Where are we to date in the federal courts? Well, from 2001 to 2011, the roadless rule wasn't in effect on the Tongass. That was a combination of successful litigation and USDA rulemaking that exempted the Tongass. But in 2011, in an en banc decision of the Ninth Circuit, they invalidated the existing exemption rule and applied the roadless rule to the Tongass. And within a couple of weeks, we filed new litigation challenging the underlying roadless rule in the district court for the District of Columbia. 8 years later, we're still fighting that battle in the courts. We've been through battles on venue, standing, statute of limitations. We got dismissed once on statute of limitations, took it up to the D.C. Circuit, was successful, got it reinstated. Finally, a couple of years ago, the district court ruled against us on the merits. We immediately appealed to the D.C. Circuit. The case has been fully briefed for some time. Last fall, we were actually on the docket for oral argument when the environmental interveners in the case moved the circuit court to hold the case in abeyance pending the final outcome of the current rulemaking with USDA. We vigorously opposed that, but they granted the abeyance. We continue to look at ways to perhaps get that abeyance lifted. If we can get that abeyance lifted and move that case to a final decision, we have any number of what we believe are solid arguments before the court. And if we prevail on that, the remedy could be anywhere from invalidation of the entire roadless rule nationwide. It could be an invalidation in Alaska. It could be invalidation on just the Tongass. It would depend which rule or which argument they would rule in our favor on. At the same time as the case has been going on, and I mentioned abeyance pending a rulemaking, in January of 2018, the state petitioned Secretary Perdue, the Secretary of Agriculture, seeking both a new rulemaking to exempt the Tongass and also a revision to the 2018 Tongass Land Management Plan. In August of 2018, he granted that petition, not in quite the way we would have liked, but there is a rulemaking that is well underway at this point with one of the alternatives to completely exempt the Tongass again. The state is actively involved in the rulemaking as we are a cooperating agency, actually on committees with the USDA as we go forward on this rulemaking. They expect a draft environmental impact statement to be issued in July of this summer and a new rule to be in place within a year after that. The alternatives will probably range everywhere from no action, keep it just as it is, up through full exemption of the Tongass, and undoubtedly some midstream alternatives in the middle. Now, even if we get a new exemption rule, or if we win the court decision, this is where the 2016 Land Management Plan comes in. Under the National Forest Management Act, it's required that every national forest have a written management plan and that United States Forest Service take all actions in compliance with that plan. In effect, that gives the forest plan the effect of law, because a violation of the forest plan by the United States Forest Service is automatically a violation of the National Forest Management Act and fully enforceable in the federal courts. So the 2016 Land Management Plan effectively not technically, but effectively, it's law. When they revised the land management plan in 2016, the Forest Service took most of the important restrictions in the roadless rule and put them into the land management plan. Now, they didn't just reference the roadless rule so that if the roadless rule is revised, the restrictions are revised. No, they actually lifted them substantively so that even if the roadless rule goes away, even if there's a new exemption rule, we have to go back and then amend the management plan, or those independent restrictions would still be enforceable, prohibiting tree cutting and road building. In our petition, we asked them to do both, but they decided that the appropriate way to do it was to first do the rulemaking and then in the second step come back and amend the management plan if necessary, depending what the rule says. So the finish line's not quite in sight yet. After 18 years, we've got a little while to go yet. I'm going to stop there with the roadless rule and answer any questions on roadless before we move on to shelter code.
Any members? Questions? No? Proceed.
Okay.
Senator?
So I know there's no exemptions, but is there boundaries outside of some of these management areas? We have some state land. We have some native land. Does it bleed off into access to some of those lands? And are we, is that some of the arguments that you have, or does it not affect them at all?
Through the chair, Senator Coghill, I'm not entirely sure what you mean by bleed off, but if what you're suggesting is, I mean, the roadless rule itself does not apply outside the boundaries, but to the extent that it limits access on the property right next door, sure, it has an effect. It may actually limit the road construction you would need to get there. If you're doing a timber sale, it may be a case where it would be an economic timber sale if you could have a state sale adjoining the federal sale. So it clearly has impacts, but not direct legal impacts.
So that's what I meant by bleed off, that,
yeah.
That it their rule affects our ability to access some lands from time to time.
Sure. I mean, in some cases, the Southeast is actually a patchwork. I mean, you might, to get someplace, you might go through federal land, state land, federal land again, and so on. So, yeah, it definitely has some impacts.
Has that been some of your arguments in the litigation?
Not directly, because it doesn't really have a legal context that I think we could put it in. And we weren't short of other legal arguments to make, so.
Yeah, it's probably more of an economic argument, but.
Yes, I would say it
the,
is.
The inability to stand up an industry because of the roadless rule has been significant.
Oh, huge. If you're talking the impact on any given sawmill,
yeah.
I mean, yeah, the state timber sales are not going to support sawmill. I mean, they've contributed heavily to it. And back in 2006, when litigation brought the federal sales to almost complete standstill, the state stepped up and really increased the state timber sales. And for several years, the state did pull the industry through, but that was not a long-term sustainable, because we were selling above on a yearly basis what would be sustainable.
Okay.
So yeah, it certainly has that effect. Is you need the federal timber to be able to maintain the timber industry to do state sales. No questions.
Other questions? Seeing none, proceed.
If we move on to Shelter Cove, let me first say that Sean Lynch, who supports our transportation system, is actually lead counsel on this, but I'm familiar enough with it to, I think, give you an overview and probably address some questions. Shelter Cove was a road construction project, and the federal government was first sued by environmental plaintiffs trying to stop this project on an environmental basis. The state intervened as a co-defendant on the side of the federal government on this. The environmental case has now been resolved in the favor of the federal government. The road is being built. But one of the arguments that was brought by the environmental groups was regarding the state's, what are known as 4407 easements that were granted to the state from Congress. And the argument was made by the plaintiffs that these easements, construction of a road on these easements, required a full NEPA process and environmental impact statement. We disagreed that it requires any impact statement. The feds agreed that it did. They actually did an impact statement. At any rate, the court has dealt with the case in terms of the plaintiffs finding in favor of the feds on all counts. However, because of our disagreement with the feds on 4407 easements, Sean actually filed a cross action against the feds. And while that was also has been decided in our favor, we have continuing an action for declaratory judgment with this court in an attempt to put to rest permanently the remaining questions on all of the other 4407 easements. If you're not familiar with 4407, just a real quick background on these. Back in 2005, in the federal highways bills, there were 19 transportation and utility easements granted by Congress to the state of Alaska. Not contingent on anything, they were granted. Now the problem has come in because at that time, those easements were not, you know, well-surveyed legal descriptions. They were red lines on a map. And the work hadn't been done to properly locate those or really identify them down to where you could, you know, build a road. And as we've become more refined on these lines, we realize that these lines go through lakes, they go over cliffs. I mean, you can't build a road over most of these red lines. You just can't do it. So in simple terms, the issue is the federal government's position has been if you move outside of that red line to relocate the easement to something that is feasible, maybe even less environmental impact, they're saying that that is a new federal decision subject to NEPA, subject to an environmental impact statement, fully reviewable and subject to court action. The state's argument has been, no, no, no. The easement is fully granted, and Congress, and actually they went back and added to the bill to make it clear that this was an intent. Their argument is that the easement shows a right to go from point A to point B, and that there is flexibility for the state to figure out where that best alignment is, and that once the state has done that, and they've gone through permitting process with the Army Corps of Engineers and whatever the federal permits are needed, that all the United States Forest Service has the authority to do is the ministerial act of actually issuing an easement and recording it, that they don't have any decision process. So that's the issue that remains before the Federal District Court in Alaska, and we're hoping if that's ruled in our favor, then the remaining 15 4407 easements should be a done deal, a done issue. Yes?
What's the timeline on that?
Through the chair, Senator Coghill, the federal final brief on that one is due, I think, this week or next, and I think there's one reply brief. So the briefing should be done within 30 days, I think, give or take. And once the briefing's done, I doubt if he's going to hear argument on it, so I would suspect it'll be ripe for decision. And I long ago stopped even guessing how long it takes from when it's ripe until you. I've waited a year and a half from one federal judge, so that's the timeline. Within 2 years, I would say.
Just a quick question on what's an example of a 440? I mean, is that what we're looking at here? I'm just like the Shelter Cove Road. Is that
the
example?
That was in 447. The title 4407 simply was the section of the 2005 highway bill that provided them, so they've always been called 4407
okay.
easements.
Okay, yeah, I wasn't familiar with that.
Just a matter of those 19 on the map.
Yeah, well, thank you for explaining that.
Mr. Chairman, if you want to not only get a good education on it, but enjoy listening to Don Young, I think you can probably get a couple of his comments from the record on that.
Great, thank you. Proceed.
That will bring me to my last item, the King Cove to Cold Bay Road through the Eisenbeck Refuge. And although I have several cases that are controversial and people are passionate about, this one probably has more passion on both sides than any of the others, because this one actually is life and death for some people in the village of King Cove. Just in terms of background, Cold Bay is a village of about 80 people. That's on the west side of the Alaska Peninsula, but it happens to have an airport with a 10,000-foot all-weather runway with full instrumentation. I believe that was a World War II project. But it continues to serve not only scheduled service, but it's also an emergency runway for incoming jumbo jets from the Pacific. I think they're a little short of hotel space when that happens, but can't land safe. On the other side of the peninsula is the village of King Cove, which is closer to 1,000 people. It has a gravel runway to accommodate smaller craft during daytime operations only. It's surrounded by mountains, the ocean, and the Eisenbeck Refuge. So there is no land route to get over to the King Cove Airport. I mean, the Cold Bay Airport. They also have notoriously bad weather there, wind, rain, fog. So there are many days in the course of every year where even the Coast Guard cannot get into King Cove. And as a result, there have been a number of people who have died while waiting for medical evac. It's hard to say if that was exactly the cause, but certainly it may have been in some cases. And so for decades, actually, King Cove has been attempting to see if they could get it's about 10 miles long, one-lane gravel road through the refuge so that they could do land transport over to the Cold Bay Airport, and that would allow for medical evac almost every day of the year with limited exceptions. We've been litigating for many years now. I was first involved with a 2009 land exchange that was authorized by both the United States Congress and by this body. And it was subject only to the Secretary of Interior's approval based on an environmental impact statement. Secretary Jewell was adamant about not allowing the road. And our Alaska delegation was pretty passionate in the other direction. So we lost that case in federal district court, and then it was actually withdrawn in the Ninth Circuit. Because of the change in federal administrations, it was possible to work out a new land exchange. And whereas in the first land exchange, the state was a party and was going to be exchanging about 50,000 acres of state land, in the current land exchange, the exchange is solely between the Department of Interior and the King Cove Corporation. And under NEPA, there is a special provision that specifically states that exchanges between the federal government and a native corporation are exempt from an environmental impact statement. So that land exchange has been completed, but of course there was a lawsuit challenging it. And while the state's was not party to the land exchange or to the case initially, the state did file an amicus brief supporting the land exchange. That case has now been fully briefed, and it's ripe for decision, so that's one where we're just waiting for Judge Gleason to rule. And then, of course, there's a possibility of circuit action and so on. It's important to note that the land exchange itself does not authorize a road. It's a real estate transaction. And once the land exchange would be completed, then there would have to be construction permits requested through the Army Corps of Engineers. The state of Alaska, our Department of Transportation, was involved substantially in identifying the best route and identifying the lands that were sought in the land exchange. And should approvals be granted to design and build the road, as the state normally does or often does with small communities, the state will play a key role in design and construction of the road, which would ultimately be turned over to, I believe, the borough in this case. And that's all I have for you today, and I'm happy to take questions on any of the topics.
Well, that's great. That's very, very comprehensive. Thank you very much. See if there are any questions. Senator Kawasaki?
Thank you. Thanks for being here today. And it's just a question, I guess, generally, when or what's sort of the decision tree that you choose to either become party to litigation or not become party to litigation?
Through the chair, Senator Kawasaki, I may ask my section chief to speak to that. Certainly, my experience has been is you know, there's discussion with the parties, such as with King Cove or whoever are the active litigants, generally we get invited in usually. But it, as far as internal, I mean, you know, my decision tree goes to the section chief and the attorney general, and I think often the governor's office. Mm-hmm. So would you like to add to that?
Sure. Yeah. I mean, one of the things we have to consider is, and through the chair to Senator Kawasaki, is there are certain requirements you have to meet to actually intervene in a case. You have to have a certain legal standing, whereas if you're just appearing as an amicus, it's you have a lot easier ability to weigh in. So that's one consideration. And then another consideration is you can at times if you actually become a party, you don't want to do that if you're going to somehow interfere or disrupt the litigation with respect to the party you're actually supporting. So sometimes becoming a party can make things a little bit more complicated. Possibly even delay the case, whereas becoming an amicus might be a little bit more smoothly to try to have your voice heard in litigation. On the other hand, if you're intervene as a party, then you have certain legal rights that you don't have as an amicus. And very importantly, is you would have the right to weigh in substantively on any kind of resolution of the case, or even take an appeal because you'd be a formal party. Whereas if you're just appearing as an amicus, you wouldn't have those rights. So there's really pros and cons to whichever way you go, and just look at very closely at the particular case, decide, can you intervene? Do you have the legal right to do that? And then does it make sense to do that?
And follow up. Yeah, and then, the roadless rule issue, there must be other states with roadless rule problems, and I know this one's specific to the state of Alaska, but have any other states come forward, filing amicus briefs, to sort of help the position and the precedent?
Through the chair, Senator Kawasaki, yes, there have been other states with roadless issues. Actually, the state of Wyoming was sort of the lead state for some time challenging the roadless rule. They had it, an injunction against the roadless rule, for almost a decade until the Tenth Circuit finally overturned it. And we filed an amicus in their case. There are a couple of states, Colorado's one of them, that have done a state-specific roadless rule, which is what we're now engaged in doing. But as to have we actually had amicus filings by other AGs in our cases? We have not.
Okay.
Thanks. Thank you. Other questions? Seeing none?
Okay.
All right.
Well, again, Seth Bosang. If you're following along in our packet, we're now at the bottom of page 3. Okay. And the first matter I'm going to talk about is the Eastern Interior Resource Management Plan. This is an issue that is not currently in litigation, but it's on our list because it might end up there. It's something we've been following for some time. We've been weighing in before the Bureau of Land Management with our views. And what is going on here is BLM has adopted this management plan. It's in an area in the eastern part of the state. Specifically covers the 40 Mile River region. It's an area with high mineral potential. And the plan that was adopted by BLM recommends various mineral closures, which are of concern to the state, and also does not recommend the lifting of many of the Section 17D1 withdrawals, which were withdrawals under ANCSA, which Congress has pressed BLM to expedite their process for lifting these. In many instances, the state has top-filed selections for these lands, so those can't become effective until these withdrawals are lifted. And the plan mysteriously doesn't recommend lifting those, as Congress has strongly urged BLM to do. So right now we're dealing with a plan that contains a lot of recommendations. What the next step that's going to happen is there's going to be a series of subplans that will actually implement those recommendations. So that's what we're watching for, and depending on what those subplans look like and how they implement those recommendations will sort of determine what the state's next steps are as far as possibly taking some litigation action.
Okay, thank you.
Mr. Chairman.
Senator Kaga.
Within this plan are these areas of environmental concern that if they don't lift the D1 restrictions, then it's really a de facto wilderness taking, isn't it?
Through the chair, to Senator Kaga, that's exactly right. I mean, that again, is a recommendation at this point, but, you know, what they seem to be trying to do rather than lifting these withdrawals is, you know, almost creating some kind of super conservation system unit that would really impact development or natural resource management.
And Mr. Chairman, I just noticed that you said inconsistent, and I would say contrary. So I'm just, that's just my opinion. So thank you.
Well taken.
All right. Thank you. Continue.
So moving on to page four then, next matter I'll talk about is the lands and the trust matter. Brief history of this. For a long time, until the Akiachak litigation, the position of the Department of Interior in regulation was that there was an Alaska exemption for taking lands into trust. That's not the course that was chosen for Alaska through ANCSA. The course was decided to not follow the reservation system that was adopted in the lower 48, and that seemed clear to everyone. Until the district court took a different view in the Akiachak litigation, and subsequently the Department of Interior then adopted that view, adopted regulations, and then adopted a solicitor's opinion, which justified that, basically adopted the district court's legal reasoning that that lands into trust was allowed in Alaska. Well, in the last summer, the Department of Interior rescinded that solicitor's opinion and invited comment on sort of the next steps for lands into trust in Alaska. And this past January, the state submitted its comment letter, has urged the Department of Interior to revert back to its position, which we think is clearly the sort of the obvious result under ANCSA, that lands should not be taken into trust. There should not be Indian country with it, one exception under ANCSA. So we're basically waiting to see what the Department of Interior is going to do, and that will determine the state's next steps with respect to lands and trust.
Senator Cargill.
So they've made a proposal, and just give me an idea of their expected timeline for a comment and what their expected decision points are.
You know, the state has already submitted its comments.
I'm talking about the Department of Interior, what their expected decision points are.
Right. And so the reason I mentioned that is because I think the state submitted its comments at a time when comments were due in January, but then the comment period was extended. I hate to say it because I'm not remembering, but I think it might be even later this month is the comment deadline. As far as I know, there's no sort of set timeline after that for the Department of Interior to make its decision. Once it takes all its comments in, it'll sort of be up to them to figure out what timeline they're gonna figure out where they're gonna go with this.
Mr. Chairman, I've just all expressed my own frustration to that whole process because they put a deadline on us with no cap on their decision-making process. I find that troublesome. So, there's nothing we can do about it, but. Thank you for commenting. Appreciate it.
Senator Keel.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So in many ways, ANCSA was kind of the last gasp of the termination era in federal Indian law. So I apologize, I haven't read the state's comment letter. Is it the state's executive branch's position that nothing in federal Indian law has changed applicably to Alaska since then?
Through the chair to Senator Keel, I'm not sure I completely followed the question. The state's position is that that ANCSA settled Native claims and chartered a new course, not to not have the reservation system, to not have Indian country as was followed in the lower 48. So the district court in Accia-Chak determined that ANCSA did not resolve that issue and that lands could still be taken into trust and we could still have Indian country, but the state's position is that that was settled with ANCSA.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. It just strikes me that the question of the reservation system versus whether tribes may have land they own fee simple taken into trust is a different question.
Thank you. Thank you. Could you explain maybe what the real world consequences of lands into trust? I mean, what does that mean? I mean, you know, to somebody that's not really immersed in the issue or the discussion.
Sure, Chairman Burch, I'd be glad to. So, there's 229 federally recognized Native tribes in Alaska, and there are land holdings by those tribes throughout the state, and they're not contiguous. They're spread out and in a haphazard manner, and taking lands into trust is one of the ways to create Indian country, which would determine or impact the state's ability to have control over natural resource management, to have control over environmental regulation, and it's unclear because it would probably depend on which lands are taken into trust and how many and how often is accepted, but it's certainly could have a huge impact if many lands were taken into trust and we had these sort of areas of Indian country spread throughout the state could make it very, very difficult for the state to do all the kinds of things that it does otherwise.
Thank you. Senator Bishop.
Isn't it, thank you, Mr. Chairman. Isn't it a slam? It's not a slam dunk. It's a high bar, isn't it, for to convert one of these into trust, for a tribe to convert it into land into trust?
Through the chair, Senator Bishop, I know that there are several applications that are pending with the Department of Interior. I think there's been one that's been accepted. I'm not familiar with the sort of the process for making those decisions, but it's.
That's fine.
Yeah.
Thank you.
Thank you.
All right. Proceed.
Sure. Glad to. So the next matter is the ANWR boundary dispute, and this is a long-standing dispute we've had with the federal government over the northwestern boundary of ANWR, and it's now before the Interior Board of Land Appeals. The dispute is that everyone agrees that the boundary that is in question is the westernmost bank of the Canning River. The state's view is that the river is exactly that, that it's the Canning River that everyone knows, that everyone can see, that everyone sees the water flowing through. BLM's view is that it's some other part, that the rivers moved, and that they are taking the position that this line, what they're calling the Canning River, actually runs through many, many miles of open tundra. And that's what's on appeal before the Interior Board of Land Appeals. It covers it would impact about 20,000 acres, which would either be revert to state land or, if BLM prevails, it would be within ANWR. And this is land that has potential for obviously oil and gas development, but maybe even more potential for staging for oil and gas development within the refuge. So it's the state views this as very, very important, and the case has been fully briefed before the IBLA, and we are just waiting for that decision. Unfortunately, the IBLA is not a good track record of issuing prompt decisions, and it appears that there's quite a bit of backlog, so we could be waiting for some time before we get our decision, but that's where that case stands.
You know, we just passed a resolution this morning encouraging a lease sale to proceed with they're evaluating four alternatives, as I recall the BLM is. And is this tied into that? And one, I mean, I'm not sure the boundaries of the lease sale, but how is there a relationship to this?
You know, I don't think it is, and I don't think – I think, you know, however it's resolved, it will either be, you know – however it's resolved, it will not – I don't think it's going to impact the lease sale, if that makes sense. It's everyone knows about the dispute. We know it's going to be resolved one way or the other, so I don't think it's – it's not something that would hold up the lease sale, if that's the question.
Yeah, it's some miles west of Kaktovik, and I guess the area that they're actually looking at. Okay, great. Thank you. Questions? Seeing none, proceed.
And so the next matter is probably something that was talked about in your resolution, which is the 1002 matter, and that's the area of the refuge that's now open for leasing under the Tax Cuts and Jobs Act of 2017. What we're following in that matter is the draft EIS. The state has been a cooperating agency with respect to that environmental impact statement. It's obviously a necessary step before leases could go forward. So that EIS is out for comment. I think the state's comments are actually going to be submitted this week on the EIS, and then we'll be waiting for the final EIS. And it's a matter that probably has a lot of people's attention, could be subject to litigation. Obviously, the state's going to be ready to help defend and stand on the side of the federal government to defend that whatever lease decisions are made. Obviously, under the Act, the federal government is required to have the two lease sales within 10 years, and 50% of those revenues are going to come to the state of Alaska. So it's something we're, obviously of great interest to the state.
Just as a point of information, I think it's 9:59 p.m. on Wednesday, March 13th is the deadline for public comment. In case you're trying to get something off your desk, there. Thank you.
Thank you, Chairman. And so then I'll turn it over to my colleague, Ms. Pocan.
Good afternoon, Chairman Birch and members of the committee. I'm Emma Pocan in the environmental section in the department, so I'll be covering the next three matters here that are being handled by my section. All three of these items refer to nationally applicable EPA regulations, and while there's a few different problems with each of the rules, they all kind of reflect as they're applied to Alaska anyway, a little bit of a square peg round hole theme. Also, for all three of these regulations, the agency, generally with some prompting from a presidential executive order, is reevaluating these rules. So in the past, when we gave you summaries on these matters, they would have said that we were not aligned with the federal government. But at this point, pending the outcome of those rulemakings, it's uncertain at this point. So the first item is the 2017 regional haze rule. In that regulation, EPA changed the requirements for how states improve visibility around Class 1 areas. The statute defines Class 1 areas as national parks, wilderness areas, over a certain acreage that were established before 1977. We have four in Alaska. Three of them are in really remote islands that are difficult or even dangerous to reach, don't really have much human traffic, and were established for migratory bird habitat. The fourth is Denali National Park. So with the regional haze, the sources can be natural, wildfires, forest fires, or volcanic activity, among others. There's also human sources, road dust, power plant or refinery emissions. And so, for example, the 2012 consent decree between the federal government and Golden Valley Electric Association that requires pollution controls to be put on Healy Power Plant or to shut down Unit 1 by 2024, that was driven in part by concerns over a contribution to regional haze close to Denali National Park and impeding the viewshed. But it's not just local sources of regional haze that are concerned under the rule. For Alaska, we have documented contributions from what's called Arctic haze from sources like smelter plants in Siberia and dust storms over the Mongolian or Northern China deserts. And so these particulates really can be carried a long distance and have been documented to be impacting regional haze around Denali. And in the past, EPA has said, well, we recognize that you, State of Alaska, can't control this international activity, so we're not going to expect that you're going to do something to address it. And in the 2017 rule at issue here, EPA said that they weren't changing that position, but then they went on to say, but we're going to require you to use a scientifically valid methodology and data to prove and to quantify what that contribution is, in order for you to not basically have to reduce in-state sources of haze to compensate for the international contribution. So we think really that kind of international modeling of air currents, weather, is an EPA responsibility under the statute. And so we did challenge the 2017 rule on that basis, among others, as did some other states. But the briefing on that is now on hold because the EPA administrator came out last year and said that they're going to reevaluate the rule and set a timeline, published what they're calling the Regional Haze Roadmap. So we're expecting that this spring we'll see some additional guidance from EPA, including a modeling platform and a revised rule somewhere down the road. The next item is the Clean Power Plan. This was a 2015 EPA rule regulating carbon emissions from power plants. And in that rule, EPA looked at, you know, the overall demand for electricity and the overall generating capacity. And then they said, well, you know, everybody's connected to the interstate interconnected transmission grid, so you can reduce carbon emissions by generating more power from renewables and natural gas and less from coal. The state commented on that rule, pointed out that we weren't connected to the interstate transmission grid, and also that to the extent we do have an in-state transmission grid, there's constraints on that, right? So the rule effectively assumed that we were going to be able to replace Healy generation with Bradley Lake, which has some challenges, including constraints in the transmission system and reliability issues. Ultimately, EPA did exempt the State of Alaska from that final rule when it was published, but they also kind of indicated that they might come back later and put something in place for us. A number of other states did challenge the rule in court. We didn't join that litigation because it wasn't really a final rule for us. But we're certainly watching it with interest, in part because EPA said that they might come back, and also because the rule reflected really a broader approach to EPA's authority under the Clean Air Act than the traditional approach. You know, usually they look at a facility and they say, okay, let's look at the costs and what's technologically feasible and what you can do to really get your emissions under control. But here they looked at the entire industry and they picked winners and losers. And it really was a pretty dramatically different approach to how they were exercising their authority.
I have a question for Senator Conco.
Are you moving on from this? Because I just wanted to ask you a question on other litigation. You probably are watching it. I read some briefs that showed some real constitutional questions on this particular rule, based on what you just said of a new method of management, basically, rather than an air quality issue. So. Is that percolating up through the courts?
So the case is actually being held in abeyance pending the outcome of a new rulemaking. The EPA has proposed a new rule, what they're calling the Affordable Clean Energy Rule. And this new proposed rule really takes a more traditional approach. They're looking at coal plants and saying, what heat rate improvements can you accomplish at your coal plant? How can you use your coal more efficiently so that you're emitting less carbon per kilowatt hour generated? So the comment period on that rule closed in October, and we're waiting to see what comes out as a final rule.
Thank you.
And then the final item for the environmental section is the Waters of the U.S. or WOTUS rule. So the Clean Water Act applies its regulatory programs to navigable waters, and then the statute defines navigable waters as waters of the United States, including the territorial seas. Something of a notoriously ambiguous definition, there's been a long history of EPA and the Army Corps of Engineers defining the term and issuing various regulations. providing further guidance. It's important for Alaska because this rule basically determines where is a project going to be subject to federal requirements, permitting requirements, like the 404 dredge and fill permits, and where is a project going to be subject just to state regulatory requirements in terms of impacting water. The 2015 rule really reflected an even broader approach than what EPA had been taking historically. They took a very broad view of this significant nexus test, right? So you could have a subsurface connection or an ephemeral connection between an otherwise isolated body of water and a traditional navigable water, and on the basis of, you know, a single rainstorm, the federal government would be asserting jurisdiction over that isolated water body. And then they established some fixed setbacks that, you know, if you look at a jurisdictional water, if you're within a certain number of feet, you're automatically within federal jurisdiction, irrespective of whether or not there's ever any actual connection. So the state of Alaska, along with a number of other states, challenged that 2015 rule in the federal district court in North Dakota, successfully got a stay on the rule, so it's never been applied here. But again, the federal government has come back now and said that they're going to be reevaluating that rule. They've issued a proposed rule last fall. The comment period on that closes in April. But in the meantime, the summary judgment briefing has been completed in the lawsuit, and we're waiting for an oral argument date. It's a little bit of a peculiar situation because the federal government isn't defending the 2015 rule anymore. Just the environmental interveners are.
Okay. I had a question for you. In January, several of us in the Senate, including myself, Senator Giesel and Senator Coghill, signed a letter to Attorney General Clarkson questioning the EPA authority to force the state of Alaska to adopt a process for designating Tier 3 waters, which was, you know, deemed to be a pretty restrictive designation and one that gave rise to some concerns about what's actually in the state's best interest. I was wondering if you, are you undertaking any sort of assessment at this point, and I don't know if this is a waters of the U.S. It seems like we're in the right territory to be chatting about this, but I was wondering if maybe you could give us an update on where that might be at, or what sort of what you've learned, if you will.
So the Tier 3 waters program is also another Clean Water Act mm-hmm. issue. My understanding is that so there's another attorney in the section that's assigned to that issue. They certainly are looking at it actively. My understanding is that there's some pending legislation that would clarify what the state of Alaska's process would or wouldn't be. And we'll go from there once we see the outcome of this session.
Okay. Fair enough.
Mr. Chairman, at least that's an established body of water. This was anything that's wet, basically. The waters of the United States, it's almost anything that's wet.
Anything is wet.
Yeah. Ever.
Great. Thank you. Proceed.
I'll take it from here, okay. Chairman. So we're following along. We're now on page 6,
okay.
And we're getting into fish and game matters. And the first matter we'd like to give you an update on is the State v. Zinke matter. This is litigation that was filed by the state of Alaska by attorneys in our section in 2017. Challenging two rules, one by the National Park Service, one by the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service, both restricting methods and means for taking predators that are allowed under state law. The state's argument for both rules was essentially that the federal government was trying to, under ANILCA, take over primary fish or game management, which is not what ANILCA is about at all. So thankfully, after the state filed its case and after we got a new federal administration, the federal administration seems to be agreeing with our arguments because they've been backtracking quite a bit. The litigation's on hold. It's been stayed for quite some time. The National Park Service has proposed a new rule, which essentially reverses what they had proposed in almost virtually all of what they had proposed that we were objecting to. They've been scheduled to finalize that rule, and I think most recently they asked for an extension, and they're scheduled to finalize that according to the requested extension in this June. We're still waiting for the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service to propose a rule. We expect that to happen soon, and we're You'll be looking to see that they'll be taking a similar approach to the National Park Service and taking back the sort of federal overreach that they proposed under the or adopted under the prior administration. That's where that stands. The next matter is a state where we or a case where we intervened on the side of the federal government to defend action under the Congressional Review Act. It also deals with a rule by the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service, what's called the Refugees Rule, and it also deals with predator control, where this rule was adopted on the sort of eve of the Obama administration and was very quickly rescinded through the Congressional Review Act, which is the act that sort of, you know, within a certain period of time, the Congress is allowed to pass a bill that's then signed by the president that reverses the rule. That action took place. The Center for Biological Diversity sued, alleging that the Congressional Review Act was unconstitutional. Their argument seems to be that even though we have a act taken or approved by both houses of Congress and signed by the president, that somehow that's not effective to amend or to enact law. The district court agreed with the federal government and our arguments that, of course, that's constitutional. And now the case is on appeal to the Ninth Circuit. I think our brief is actually going to be filed this week, and then the appellants in the case will get a reply brief, and the court will probably schedule oral argument, and then we'll just have to wait for a decision from the Ninth Circuit.
Sir Kawasaki.
So I asked the question a little bit earlier about why we would become an intervener versus just filing an amicus. So can you just sort of run down the reason why in this case?
You know, I think I'm not sure I was privy to that decision through the chair of Senator Kawasaki. I can probably guess some reasons if you'd like me to try that.
Sure.
I think part of the decision versus intervening versus amicus, again, you know, we have to assess whether we're going to somehow disrupt the case or do something that's not going to be in sort of the interest of the side we're intervening on. That certainly wouldn't be the case here. But with respect to the interest, we have sort of a very important point to make that probably wouldn't have been made by the federal government, and that is that the state is the primary manager of game in the state. And the federal government has not always expressed it as clearly and plainly as we think it should. So I think in this case, we viewed it as we wanted to be a party. We wanted to make sure that that the court was aware that it's not that we just have sort of an opinion that we want the court to hear, but we actually have a stake in this case. We are the primary manager of game, and it's impacting our rights. As you know, in addition to sort of the federal government defending their statute, this is affecting our rights substantively. And so I think the decision probably was that it's much better to be a party to the case with that kind of interest as opposed to sort of just expressing your view of the court through an amicus.
Great. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. No other questions? Continue.
Sure. So no other questions. I'll move on to the next matter, which is the United Cook Inlet Drift Association versus National Marine Fisheries Service. This is a case where we were also on the side of the federal government. It was a case brought by commercial fishermen who were unhappy that the fishery management plan for salmon fisheries in Alaska did not include the federal waters of Cook Inlet. The federal waters of Cook Inlet have always been managed exclusively by the state. The fisheries in those waters have always been managed exclusively by the state since statehood. The commercial fishermen in that case believe that it should be managed by the federal government under the Madison-Stevens Act, even though that had never been done. And we prevailed in the district court, but in the Ninth Circuit, we did not prevail. And the Ninth Circuit ruled that was a violation of the Madison-Stevens Act, that these federal waters had to be included within a fishery management plan. It's possible that, and perhaps likely, that management authority will ultimately be delegated to the state. However, you know, when a fishery is managed under the Madison-Stevens Act, there are a number of requirements that are going to be at issue or in play that are not when it's managed exclusively under state law. So What happened is once the Ninth Circuit issues its decision, it remanded back to the agency to adopt a new fishery management plan that would include Cook Inlet. Unfortunately, the litigation is also going to affect two other fisheries that are in the same situation as Cook Inlet, which are outside of, or near Copper River and near False Pass, which are two other historical fisheries that have always been managed by the state but are now going to have to be included within a fishery management plan. The North Pacific Fishery Management Council decided to proceed with Cook Inlet first, so that's what's happening now. And we always expected this was going to be a pretty lengthy process. It always is to adopt a new fishery management plan. The council has formed a committee that includes the plaintiffs in that case and other stakeholders to make recommendations to the council. I believe the committee had its first meeting in December, and they're going to meet again at least two more times before the council meets in April. But we're not expecting a new plan or even a proposed plan in April. It's going to be probably, you know, a year or more before we even get a draft plan that would be available for comment.
Senator Rainbold,
just,
question?
Just real quick, this just goes against a lot of the normal vein that a lot of Alaskans think, you know, that we want control of our own resources. So just a quick, why would they want the federal government to, the fishermen, the commercial fishermen, why would they want feds to take control? It doesn't make any sense to me.
You know, I was involved in litigation, and I have my suspicions about that. I mean, I guess they're a little bit more than suspicions, because I think they were a little bit open about it, that they believe that the Board of Fisheries was not managing the resource the way that it needed to be and the way that they thought it would be under the Magnuson-Stevens Act. So that the group of commercial fishermen, obviously, as they're appeared before the Board of Fisheries, you know, over a long period of time, and it was a constant complaint, even was subject to prior litigation, that they were trying to compel federal management because they believed that that would be a better management of the resource. I think they were willing to have the state be the actual implementation of the manager, but they wanted those federal standards to apply.
Okay, thank you. Proceed.
So next we have a case that the state filed with a number of other states challenging rules under the Endangered Species Act that really expanded the ability of the National Marine Fisheries Service to designate critical habitat. Amazingly, allowed the federal government to designate critical habitat even if the species did not live in the area, and even if the land did not possess the features that would enable the species to live, the thinking being that perhaps the land could be altered and could gain those necessary features in the future, nevertheless could be considered critical habitat, which is obviously a really big issue for the state. With we've been down this road before with endangered species and the federal government designating huge areas as critical habitat. So when these rules came out, it was of something we were paying close attention to, and we ultimately joined 17 other states to challenge the rules. In 2018, a settlement was reached, and the federal government agreed to submit revised rules, which they've proposed rules, which they've done. The comment period is now closed, so we're waiting for those rules to be finalized.
Thank you. Proceed.
The next matter is the Circle Hard Rock Mining case, and this is a case where the EPA was compelled through litigation to adopt rules for financial responsibility for hazardous substances, and under CERCLA, the argument was that they were required to adopt these rules, and they're required to do it for certain classes of industries. And after EPA was unsuccessful in opposing that litigation, they decided that the first industry class they would adopt these rules for would be hard rock mining, which caused a number of states, including Alaska, to be quite concerned that the rules would be first duplicative, burdensome, because all of these states, including Alaska, have, you know, very robust financial responsibility regulations and statutes, and to suddenly have a federal program for this seemed duplicative and even worse, possibly preemptive, could have essentially sort of a one-size federal rule that would preempt all these sort of unique adaptive state rules that have been working successfully just for some time. Well, in December 2017, EPA reversed itself and withdrew its proposed rule, was subsequently sued for that, and the state of Alaska and a number of other states have intervened to defend EPA's decision to withdraw that proposed rule. And turning to the last page and the last matter we'll talk to you about today is League of Conservation Voters versus Trump. This is a case where on the sort of twilight of the Obama administration, President Obama issued an order, executive order, withdrawing large portions of the Chukchi and Beaufort Seas from oil and gas leasing. And shortly after the Trump administration came into office, President Trump issued an order reversing that decision. Well, the League of Conservation Voters sued and argued that under the Outer Continental Shelf Lands Act, their argument is that when sort of one president acts to withdraw these areas from leasing, that that decision can only be reversed by an act of Congress and could not be modified by a further executive order from a subsequent president. The act allows the withdrawal of these lands from leasing, quote, from time to time under the act. And we think it's clear that that language has been interpreted in other statutes to mean that these decisions can be revisited. And where the case stands is we're in the district court. The state of Alaska is a party through intervention, and we've had oral arguments. We're just waiting for a decision from the district court on that case.
A question on equity. When you look at the Gulf of Mexico, I mean, they're leasing. They seem like, I mean, it doesn't seem to be any impediment to offshore, OCS leasing theirs. Is that argument carry water at all? I mean,
In this case, what we're doing is we're defending a executive order that we actually agree with because President Trump reversed the decision. So. If we were in a different situation, if we were still under sort of the Obama ban, that might be an argument that we'd be making. But since we're defending the decision by President
Trump, equal footing with
right.
The states are doing.
Right. So since we're, yeah.
Great. Questions? Senator?
Just make sure I understand the legal argument. It boils down to you can withdraw from time to time has to mean you can reinstate, even if it doesn't say that.
Well, that language from time to time is used in other federal statutes, and other courts have determined that what that means is that it can be revisited. So, in our view, it's unusual that you would have a situation where, by president proclamation, you could have a decision that could never be reversed by a subsequent president. That would be that. We don't think that's what the act means, and that would be kind of unusual that Congress would give one particular president that authority to make a decision that would stand forever until reversed by an act of Congress. So, our argument is that from time to time means that this decision by a subsequent president can be revisited.
Gotcha. Thanks.
Other questions, Senator?
New topic. Thank you. I think this is a good briefing. Probably one of the perennial questions that we look for that we'd hope to get some movement on before the 21st century ends is RS-2477 access issues. And so we're looking for some precedent, both from other states like Utah, I think, for example, and some precedent. The Otna case was looking for a kind of precedent. So that going through native allotments or some of those private lands is one issue. The other issue is getting some of them settled with the federal government. Are we looking for a precedent case, or are we just going to have to fight for each square inch of right-of-way? I mean, just help me understand. I hear that Colorado may be trying to do blocks where we might want to follow suit on something like that. Has that been a legal concept percolating up, or do we need to try something else?
Through the chair, Senator Cockell, thanks for the question. So, a couple things. We have a very robust program for asserting our rights to RS-2477s and asserting the sort of public rights to access those rights of way. We've got two cases in litigation currently. The Otna case you mentioned is headed to trial, and we also have the case near Chicken, where we've been through one aspect of the case through a condemnation proceeding, and now we're moving on to actually quieting title against the federal government for the remainder of the rights of way. So we are aggressively litigating those issues. On the other hand, we are also looking for a way to it would be nice if we didn't always have to fight the federal government on these issues. So I think there's to the extent that we can set some precedents and be in a situation where we can possibly get the federal government to sort of just agree, that's something that I think we're pursuing.
When we started down, Mr. Chairman, recordable disclaimer, I was hoping that maybe it would translate into some of our land access issues. So I know on the Otna issue that will probably be a precedent, but I don't know if the Chicken one will. And so as we look, I just buried my dad who worked on those things, and I'm afraid that we'll all get buried while we're still dealing with it, and we'll pass it off to the next generation. It'd be nice if we could start thinking in bigger terms on how do we take the federal government on maybe whole areas of access. I'm thinking out loud, but maybe because when I was cleaning out my dad's closet, I saw a bunch of maps with RS-2477s on them. I'm thinking, oh man, you know, we should probably revisit this again. Anyway, that's the only reason I brought it up is the passing of my dad just reminded me that this is an amazing task, and we've got to get some bigger look at this. So I'm bringing it up as a matter of frustration, but also kicking it open for ideas. And so I know the Otna thing might be a presidential one, but with the federal government, we need to set a precedent. So
thank you, Senator.
What it's worth. Thank
Thoughts
you.
On that? Or?
Well, I agree, and I'm going to pass your sentiments along to the so that we have an in-house expert attorney who litigates these cases all the time, and thanks for your comments.
Sorry for venting.
Sure.
Oh, that's great. Are you questions? Actually,
Mr. Chairman, not a question. I want to thank the Department of Law for being here again. I think it was about 4 years ago the Senate Resources Committee established the tradition of having Department of Law come and update us on these. I actually brought last year's with me because I saved these with my notes on them, and I appreciate these updates. I don't know about the rest of the members, but it makes me proud of our Department of Law. You are really following these issues, and you're working hard on behalf of the state and our rights. So thank you.
Well said.
Thank you, Senator.
Yeah, I would echo those comments, and thank you very much, Seth, Emma, and Tom, for being here this afternoon and joining us. I think we had a great insight perspective on all the good work you're doing in the Department of Law to protect Alaskans' interests. And I think it's amazing to me the depth and breadth of the engagement. So thank you. Thank you very much. I would note that our next Resources Committee meeting will be held 3:30 on Wednesday, March 13th, in a couple of days, when we will take up SB 70, an act repealing the Ocean Rangers Program. With that, this meeting is adjourned at 4:44 p.m.